questions.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
So if anybody has a question they'd like to ask based on the things that we've heard, I would just ask that when you ask your question, stand up and hold the mic as close to your face as possible.
Hopefully this will work. Howdy.
Hi.
I agreed with a lot of what you said, but I'm trying to understand like the workability of your approach because it seems like you don't really like positivism.
It seems like I don't like what?
You don't like positivism. Like you think it seems to divorce from the idea that like God has articulated all law. And I like positivism. I like God's law too. But the question that really came into my head was kind of a question of application, specifically the Defense of Marriage Act. I think we all know that God intended marriage to be between a man and a woman. But the Defense of Marriage Act allowed Congress to say, or Congress, in the Defense of Marriage Act, Congress allowed states to say, we're not going to apply full faith and credit to other state decisions as required by Article 4 of the Constitution. So in essence, the Constitution and God's law diverge. How would your approach or your reading, or if you were put on the Supreme Court, assess this kind of tension?
Okay, very good question. Let me start with the first part about positive law versus natural law or the idea of the law of nature. And I would say, first of all, I believe in positive law. I mean, positive law is just a term we use for man-made law. The question is that the ultimate definition of what law is? And there, I think we have to go to something higher, or we don't really have any basis for judging whether law is good or bad other than human whim at the time. Now, the question concerning the Defense of Marriage Act, and this is a difficult question. What we're talking about here is the fact that several states have legalized same-sex marriage, and others may do so, and what they want to do in marriage, I'd probably say, is their business, but the problem concerns the full faith and credit clause. Now, this is a clause in Article 4 of the Constitution, which says that each state must give full faith and credit to the legal acts of any other state. For example, if I do a will in Alabama and the will is valid under Alabama law requires two witnesses for a will. If I take it up to North Dakota to have it probated, and North Dakota, in fact, requires three witnesses to a will, well, North Dakota is bound by the Full Faith and Credit Act to give full faith and credit to my will because it was valid where it was contracted. That's the idea of full faith and credit. How do you apply that then to marriage? Let's say if Vermont has same-sex marriage and two people of the same sex get married in Vermont, or at least go through a ceremony in Vermont, and then they come down to Texas and they say, what Vermont hath joined together, let not Texas put asunder. Does Texas have to recognize that same-sex marriage? Well, by a literal reading of the Full Faith and Credit Clause, they possibly would. But the way the courts have interpreted this, and they can go back to some of the concepts at the time of the Constitution itself to suggest that the term itself was not intended to have an absolutist interpretation, but rather that if a state has a strongly held public policy against same-sex marriage, it will not have to give full faith and credit to a same-sex marriage. And that's the reason why you've seen in 30-some states the adoption of either statutes or constitutional provisions that define marriage as between one man and one woman, because that is their way of establishing that this is contrary to our strongly held policy in our state. And the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level is simply reinforcing the right of states not to apply that, and saying that states have the right to not apply it as they see fit. Now, I'm frankly a little torn on the Defense of Marriage Act for two reasons. That is the federal one. The state ones I have no problem with. At the federal level, first of all, I'm not really sure that defining marriage is any of the federal government's business. That really is a matter that should belong to the states. But on the other hand, if we're going to have federal courts defining marriage the wrong way and forcing that definition on the states, then maybe we need the Congress to define it right. And so, in other words, I might have a little difficulty applying my theory on that literally here, because the courts are not restricting themselves to their appointed role as the ones who simply interpret laws rather than making laws. I like the way Alexander Hamilton puts it in the Federalist Papers when he says that the legislature exercises will, the executive exercises force, the judiciary only exercises judgment. And so, he says, the judiciary is the least dangerous branch of government. I'm not sure he would think so if he saw it in operation today. Now, the Foundation for Moral Law, for which I serve as legal counsel, we filed a friend of the court brief defending the Defense of Marriage Act, and right at the time we filed it, in fact, I think it was a couple days before we filed it, the president announced that the administration is not going to defend the act itself. A federal judge in Massachusetts had struck the act down as unconstitutional. Government had appealed, and then in an about-face, the attorney general, speaking for the president, simply said, we're not going to defend this. We don't think it's constitutional, and we're not going to defend it, which really the attorney general of the United States has the duty to present a defense of federal laws, whether he personally likes them or not. So we thought our brief was especially important since, in our opinion, the Obama administration had abdicated its responsibility in that area. Now, just a couple of days ago, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, the appellate court for New England, has announced that they're putting this case on hold because Representative John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, and the, can't remember the name of the committee of the House, has said that the House is going to step in and present a defense of the act where the president is not, and so they're deferring the case until such time as the House has acted, and we'll see what develops there. But again, I would prefer that this matter be left to the states entirely. But if the courts are going to usurp a role that doesn't belong to them and start defending or redefining marriage in the wrong way, well, maybe Congress needs to step in and make sure it's defined right. Okay, other questions?
Speaking of states speaking or pushing back, the doctrines of imposition, interposition, and nullification have arisen once again, and before the legislatures of a number of states, there are measures to nullify Obamacare, and even here in Texas, a measure which in effect is a form of nullification would forbid the Transportation Safety Agency from the practice of invasive groping, and also the whole body scanners. Would you like to comment on that, Dr. Eidsmo?
Okay, this whole question about interposition and nullification brings us back to the early 1800s where this became an issue, but question is it a power reserved to the states? And my opinion is that it is. And I would address that, first of all, that you look to what Jefferson says in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. And there he says that the Constitution is a compact among the states with the federal government. And he said, each state has the right to decide when the compact has been breached and the right to decide what the remedy for the breach should be, including, he said at the time, nullification of the breach by nullifying the law that breaches it, or he would have gone so far even to say secession. Now, you look to early in the 1800s as well, and you find at this time that the New England colonies, at the urging of Gouverneur Morris, the man who really wrote the final draft of the Constitution, that the New England colonies are talking about seceding from the United States and forming what they want to call the New England Confederacy, based on their dissatisfaction with some policies of Jefferson. As you move into the mid-1800s, you start seeing nullification issues arising, and Senator John C. Calhoun is one of the main advocates of nullification. He was vice president under Andrew Jackson, and he resigned as vice president because he couldn't support Jackson's position on that issue. Jackson did not believe in nullification, and Calhoun did. By the way, if you want to do some interesting reading on this, I would urge you to go to the work produced by Liberty Fund in Indianapolis. It is called Union and Liberty, the Political Writings of John C. Calhoun. It's about this thick, and I particularly urge you to read his disquisition on government and his disquisition on the Constitution. I learned a lot from reading it. Among the things I learned was the word disquisition. It means a lengthy and systematic discourse. But anyway, he makes some very compelling arguments for nullification and for secession, but he's talking more nullification at this time, and it wasn't in context of slavery then. At that time, the issue concerned tariffs, and many of the southern states at that time thought that the North was profiting from tariffs on southern goods, and the treasury was being enriched at their expense, and so some of the southern states wanted to nullify tariffs as they applied to ports within their jurisdiction, and South Carolina, and I could go into lengthy historic reasons why South Carolina took the lead in this throughout this period, but anyway, South Carolina becomes a leader in arguing for the right of a state to nullify an act of Congress as that act applies within its state. And Henry Clay comes down and tries to mediate on this and reach a solution. And what's interesting is throughout this time, you find that people like Henry Clay are saying to Calhoun and to those in the southern states, please don't nullify this. Please don't secede. Let's see if we can work out. Never are they saying you don't have a right to do this. That doesn't come until quite some time later with the Webster-Hain debate, and then later with the Lincoln-Douglas debate as well. But looking to the question itself as to whether it's constitutional, I would look at it this way. That, and this comes from John C. Calhoun, but Calhoun notes the 10th Amendment, which simply says the powers not delegated to the United States, that is to the federal government by this Constitution, or prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And so he asks, when we're talking about nullification or interposition or secession, is there anything in the Constitution whereby that power has been delegated to the national government? And he says no. And I challenge anybody to find otherwise. And then he says, is there anything that prohibits that power to the states? And again, he answers no. And so he says, in that case, it is a power reserved to the states or to the people. Well, the one argument to be made in contrast to this, and I'm thinking this as I'm reading Calhoun, okay, but the North still has a trump card, and Webster has an argument to make that you're not going to be able to refute, Mr. Calhoun. He notes Article 6, Section 2, that says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and all states and state judges and officials are bound thereby, anything in state laws or constitutions notwithstanding. Now, you're not going to get around that. And then, much to my surprise, Calhoun addresses that very issue and makes it into an argument for the right to nullify or secede. And he says, yes, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. But what part of the Constitution is the supreme law of the land? The obvious answer is all of it. Now, what about the amendments? Article 5 says that whenever an amendment is ratified, it is as much a part of the Constitution as any other part. So the 10th Amendment is as much a part of the supreme law of the land as any other portion of the Constitution. And since nothing in the Constitution delegates the power over secession or nullification to the federal government, and nothing prohibits that power to the state, it remains with the state, and that is the 10th Amendment, and the 10th Amendment is part of the Constitution, and therefore that is the supreme law of the land. And I've yet to see even an attempt to refute that argument. Now, if you look to the idea of interposition, we've practiced it many times. One of the early examples of interposition I would suggest to you is going back to the time of the kings of Israel, where after King Solomon becomes something of a tyrant with heavy taxes and forcing work groups and gangs and so on like this. And when he dies, we find that the people, and when it talks about the people of Israel, it's usually referring to the lower assembly, kind of like a House of Representatives. But when they come before Solomon and or before Rehoboam, his son, and say that we would like you to lower taxes, your father made them pretty heavy on us. And he says, well, come back in 3 days and I'll give you an answer. Talks to his older advisors and they say, yes, we think you ought to give them some tax relief. After all, things were pretty strict under Solomon and the people were pretty discontented about all that heavy taxation and forced labor and the like. And we think you would really endear yourself to the people if you granted some tax relief. He asked the younger advisors and they say, no, give them an inch and they'll take a mile. This is the time to show them you're tough. And he said, you're right. And so he goes out and says to the people, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins, for he has chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scorpions. 300% tax increase, effective immediate. No, no, effective retroactively. And you recall the response of the leaders of the northern tribes, to your tents, O Israel, what have we to do with the house of David? And they secede. This time it's the north seceding. Now, the fact that it was done does not mean that it was right in the eyes of God. However, you recall there was a prophet of God, we're told, when Rehoboam raised an army and came to put the northern tribes into subjection again to end this insurrection. This prophet of God comes to him and says, go not against the people of the north, for what they have done is of God. And Rehoboam accepts that, and he leaves them alone. Now, it's interesting that things don't go all that well in the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom quite quickly degenerates into chaos and instability and into infidelity to the Lord as well. And the southern kingdom does too, but not as fast. And there are certain periods of revival in the southern kingdom, not nearly as much in the north. But it's interesting, the way things develop in the northern kingdom there, that at first it sounds like Jeroboam really has things right, that he's going to run this kingdom the way it really should be run. In fact, if I had been an Israeli voter at the time, if I had had a right to vote, and my choice is between Jeroboam and limited government versus Rehoboam and centralized government, I know how I would have voted. But some of the first trouble begins to come in when it's time to offer sacrifices. And the priests are telling Jeroboam, well, it's time we have to go down to Jerusalem to offer our sacrifices. Okay, will you go ahead and offer? Wait a minute, where'd you say you were going? Jerusalem, where we always go. Not this year, you're not. You see, Jerusalem, that's the southern kingdom, that's enemy territory. You're not going to Jerusalem. In fact, we're going to send up Shechem up here, that's going to be our place where we offer our sacrifices now. Priests say, no, we can't do that. We are commanded to offer these sacrifices in Jerusalem, and we have to be faithful to God's command. And Jeroboam says, well, if you're not going to do that, then I'm appointing new priests. Okay, certainly there's some of the rest of you Levites who'd like, you won't? No? Okay, then we'll take priests out of the tribe of Gad and out of the tribe of Reuben and all these other tribes. Now, it may well be that in all of this time, Jeroboam really believed that he was doing the will of God, that he was obeying God. The problem was he was doing it according to his ideas, not according to God's ideas, not according to God's commands. I'm reminded back in my college days, or my law school days, I guess, and we had two groups on campus, Campus Crusade for Christ and InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Both were good groups and good, fine Christian groups. I tended to work more with the Campus Crusade people. And we used to have a little very good-natured rivalry between us. And I remember one of my friends would always say to the InterVarsity people, after they had a little friendly kidding, he'd say, that's all right. We're both doing the Lord's work, you in your way and we in His. Well, that was Jeroboam's way. He was doing the Lord's work, but in Jeroboam's way, not in the Lord's way. But there is one of your first instances of interposition. And in some sense, it was condoned by God. We can see it again in the Magna Carta in the year 1215 when another great constitutional hero, Stephen Langdon. How many of you heard of Stephen Langdon? Anytime you pick up your Bible, you should be thankful to Stephen Langdon, because he's the one that divided the Bible into chapters. Not verses, but chapters. And our chapter divisions today are still pretty much the way he used them, the way he developed them. But he was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leading religious official of the day, and when the Normans had conquered England and tried to usurp the old Anglo-Saxon common law with a more centralized Norman law, and when this led to tyranny under King John, Archbishop Langdon, who had come from north of the Dane law, where he was influenced by Viking law and Anglo-Saxon law, he gathered the barons and the bishops together. He instructed them from the charter of King Henry I and principles of Anglo-Saxon law and in the right of interposition against a king. He then either drafted the Magna Carta or supervised others in drafting it. We're not sure which. He took a man named Robert Fitzwalter, and he commissioned him as the Marshal of the Army of God and Holy Church. And together they met King John and his forces at Runnymede and essentially told him, you either sign the Magna Carta, which guarantees the old God-given rights of Englishmen, or else you're going to be looking for a job. And last time we checked European newspapers for King Wanted, there weren't a whole lot of ads. And besides that, we wouldn't give you good references. Well, John signed. He later claimed that he had signed under duress, and therefore it wasn't valid, and he might have some legal argument there, but there is an example of interposition. The main significance of the Magna Carta is not the rights stated therein. They were not really any new rights at all. In fact, it was a very conservative, reactionary document, just reasserting the ancient God-given rights of Englishmen against the usurpations of a Norman king. But the real significance of the Magna Carta is that it is the first time in recorded English history that local leaders, lesser magistrates, resist a higher magistrate with the threat of removing him from office if he doesn't comply. We see the same thing happening in the 1600s as the dispute continues. When you look at the dispute between the Stuart kings, you know, James the First and Charles the First, and then Charles the Second and James the Second, history books will tell you that the reason for the dispute is that the Stuart kings believed in the divine right of kings. Well, if that's all there were to it, I'd be on the side of the Stuart kings, because I certainly believe that all government is ordained of God. But the Puritans who controlled the Parliament also believed that government is ordained of God. They believed in that just as strongly as the Stuart kings and their supporters did. The issue had to do with lines of authority. The Stuart kings were saying all authority is with God. God delegates authority to the king. The king delegates authority to the lesser magistrates, the local rulers, and they in turn rule over the people. The Puritans and those in Parliament said, no, God is the source of all authority, but he delegates that authority to the people. They then established the lesser magistrates and delegate authority to them, and they delegate authority to the king. That's the way the lines of authority work. And so when Charles I was removed and charged with treason and beheaded, it was an example of interposition. And it's interesting that when they charge him with treason, I have to say that Charles I, he may not have known how to rule very well, but he knew how to die well. He conducted himself honorably, even if he was wrong. And he refused to make a defense, because if he were to defend, he would be conceding Parliament's authority over him. And he said, how can I be guilty of treason against the English people? I represent the English people. By resisting me, you people in Parliament are committing treason. Well, Might was on the side of Parliament. Whose side the people were on? Well, we didn't have any Gallup polls to show, but it is said that David Hume says that when the charge was read against the king in the House of Commons, and when the person reading the charge there, the Solicitor General, says, the Parliament brings this charge in the name of the people of England, a voice from the crowd yelled, nay, not the tenth part of them. Nobody really knows who the people sided with, but that was the issue. It's the same issue with the Declaration of Independence. Interposition. Secession, in effect, against an English king. So yes, I believe in the right of secession. I believe in the right of interposition, and I believe in nullification. That doesn't mean I think we should secede. I'm not even sure whether we should nullify at this time, although there might be instances where it's appropriate. But I believe the Constitution guarantees the right. And one of the benefits of that, as I see it, is it puts the power in the hands of the states. You didn't have to pay to come here. But if this church had charged you to come here, then you could say the power rests in our hands. Because we paid to come here, but we're not going to come here again unless you make it worth our while. In other words, you're saying to the church and to me, you have to make it worth our while or we're not coming back. Now, we've made the provision already for you here that if you don't like what you've heard here, you'll get your money back. In fact, we'll double your money back. But the point again is, I do believe in nullification. I do believe in interposition. I know that was a long answer, but I think that's a question that really does need to be addressed. Yes, sir.
We discussed this last night privately, but I'm very interested in the question of the founders' anthropology and how, in my mind, it's hard to justify the compound separation of powers, both between the different branches and between the federal and the states. And you can only do that if you have a certain view of human nature. It's a very inefficient form of government. And then you come to Washington's farewell address, as you alluded to earlier, and part of that was the need to continue to justify these separation, I forget the word he used, but to continue defending these institutions such as the separation of powers. Then you come to Darwin, and there's a shift in how mankind is viewed, and then you also made mention of Wilson and him wanting to view government more organic in a cooperative effort rather than a checks and balance system. Mm-hmm. My question is, do you still see forces at work in both our government or society or culture, whatever, based on a more Darwinian view of human nature that sees the problem not within, but the problem in the environment, trying to do away with our system of checks and balances and provide more energy for the government and more in a more centralized form? And how can we respond?
Okay, we talked about that last night. You and I did. I mean, it's a very good question dealing with what role did the concept of original sin play in the Founding Fathers' view of government? As we saw the statement from Madison in Federalist 51, if men were angels, no government be necessary. It's quite clear there that he bases his concept of limited government and checks and balances upon his view of human nature. Now, I think when you look to the Founders' view of human nature, you could clearly say they believed in original sin, not necessarily in total depravity, as a strict Calvinist or Lutheran would say it. They did believe there was some capability of human progress among people. Anyway, but yes, I think that was the belief there, and I think one of the reasons today that the whole concept of checks and balances and separation of powers seems to be just an academic issue, like, who has the power? Where are we going to put it? Well, I guess we have to look to the Constitution to find out, and I guess maybe we better follow that. But the reason for it, I think people have largely lost sight of. When they lose sight of the reason for it, it's not very long that they're going to continue to follow it. And again, the checks and balances system, the separation of powers, means that our government is not going to always be the most efficient government. In fact, I would say that there is only one thing worse than an inefficient government, and that's efficient government. It's a lot more dangerous. And Justice Jackson, in a decision, recognized that guaranteeing a certain right by the Constitution would make government less efficient. But he said, our founding fathers recognized greater values than efficiency. But we've lost sight of that. I don't think this concept of total depravity exists very much today, except in some Christian circles, primarily Calvinist and Lutheran, some Baptist as well, perhaps, the concept of original sin is still expressed, at least within a church matter, but the idea that I'm okay and you're okay, and even within the evangelical community, the desire to affirm ourselves and affirm each other and so on is so strong today that it seems we're pandering so much to what people want to hear rather than what Scripture teaches. You know, I'm going to give you one example, and this is one that bothered me. When I graduated from seminary, we chose a song that we would sing at graduation, and the choice was "Beneath the Cross of Jesus, I Feign to Take My Stand." And I think in the second verse there, and I remember exactly all the words, but "Two wonders I confess, the wonders of redeeming love, and what's it, my own," that's the new version. Originally, it was "my own worthlessness." Now it's "my unworthiness." Is there a difference in meaning there? Unworthy means I'm just not quite good enough. Maybe I'm 90% of the way there, but I'm not. I still need grace for the other 10%. Worthlessness means I'm not even at 10%. I'm at zero. But I think that change in the wording of the hymn is just one illustration of how we've gotten away from the true concept of sin. Well, let's see, it's about 1 minute to 12, so let's take time for one more.
One more question.
There's one over, this man over here has had his hand up for quite a while.
I have a question about slavery. We fought the Revolutionary War to free, I guess, the people of the country and give us liberty. 85 years later, we fought the Civil War to main purpose to free the slaves. First question, why did the founders not abolish slavery in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? And secondly, what would have been their biblical basis for freeing the slaves, abolishing slavery with the Constitution?
Okay, good question. First of all, why did they not abolish slavery when they had the Constitutional Convention? Why did the Constitutional Convention, in fact, continue to sanction slavery? This was a dispute at the convention. There were some delegates, and it wasn't always strictly the North versus the South, but some delegates believed that slavery should continue, at least for the time being, and others were strongly opposed to it in all forms and believed it should be abolished. And then you had some in between, particularly the Virginia delegates. And James Madison once said that the whole Bible is against slavery. And yet he himself did own slaves, and Patrick Henry had said something similar. He said, "How can it be that I, a professing Christian, am the owner of slaves?" And he noted that the conditions at the time, if he were to free his slaves, they'd have no way of supporting themselves in the economy, and sometimes they were legally unable to free their slaves because they were mortgaged, just like livestock might be mortgaged. But anyway, Henry simply said, "I can only resolve to treat my slaves as kindly as possible and to work and pray that this abominable institution will be abolished from the face of the earth." Well, they also argued that slavery was on the way out. It simply wasn't profitable anymore, and that leave it alone, and within a few decades, it would end on its own. And so they provided in the Constitution that Congress would not have the power to end the slave trade, not slavery, but the slave trade, for 20 years. And so in 1808, Congress did end the slave trade, that is, importation of slaves. But slavery itself did not die out as they thought. One of the reasons was the invention of the cotton gin that made plantation labor profitable again. And then you start seeing sectionalism start. You might say that slavery at first was in all of the states, although for economic reasons it just wasn't as advantageous in the North as it was in the South. And why there wasn't a stronger sentiment to abolish it, well, I think we need to note, and this is not a defense, but that slavery was, to say it's widespread would be an understatement. It would be almost universal throughout the world at the time, including the Christian and the Muslim world alike. And in fact, most of the slave trade was conducted by the New England states as they would go across to Africa and trade guns and rum and other things for slaves, trading with Muslim slave traders who in turn were getting them from African chiefs. Then they would take those to the Caribbean, and they would sell most of them in the Caribbean. The ones that didn't sell in the Caribbean, they would then sell to the South on their way back up to New England. All I'm saying here is it's a sin, but it's not only the sin of the South. And the South shouldn't be made to bear the entire blame for this sin. But I would say also that I think it's hard to say that freeing the slaves was the main purpose of the war between the states. It was a purpose. And I don't think those in the Confederate movement today who say that it had nothing to do with slavery are not being realistic. But those who say that that was the only purpose, or even the only major purpose, are also being unrealistic. In fact, I heard one Confederate supporter ask recently, okay, you say that the war was about freeing the slaves. Okay, slavery has now been abolished. Does that mean we can secede now? If the answer is no, then obviously there was something else involved. The issue of states' rights, the issue of tariffs, many other things were involved here. Anyway, so as to what provisions of the Scripture you could rely upon in seeking to abolish slavery, well, some have noted that many theologians throughout the ages have not condemned slavery because they say you can't find a clear condemnation. I think the best perspective I've ever seen on it is by E.C. Wines. Wines is writing in the early 1800s, and his work is called The Laws of the Ancient Hebrews. I recommend it very highly. It's the best work on Hebrew law that I've ever seen. In fact, in the section of my new book, I have a whole volume that is devoted to Hebrew law, and outside of the Bible itself, I've relied more on Wines than any other single source, although there are other sources too. But Wines says that sometimes God has a principle, but he doesn't institute that principle or reveal it at the very start. He notes, for example, that from the beginning, it would have been God's view that female children should inherit from their parents the same as male children. But at first, the Hebrews seemed to be following the rule of the people around them that only the male children would inherit, and that by primogeniture. And at the appropriate time, and I don't have the passage fresh in my mind, when these women come to Moses and say, we think we should be able to inherit because our brothers are dead, and rather than the money going elsewhere, we should keep it in the family and inherit. And he says, okay, that's the way it's going to be. Now, Wine says that was always the way God intended it, but the people weren't ready for that yet. Likewise, divorce law and a number of other areas. Wine said God was always against divorce, but people weren't ready to receive that, and that's why Christ says that Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, allowed divorce, but from the beginning it was not so. And Wine says the same is true of slavery. God never favored slavery, but he didn't expressly forbid it at first. When you come to the New Testament, you start seeing much more that could indicate a basis for human equality and a basis for ending slavery, and the idea that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, and that, you know, if you are a slave, you should be content in that status, but if you have the opportunity to become free, you should take advantage of that opportunity. I think the concept there is expressed, but not as a command, and you can use those to form the basis, just like with the founding fathers themselves. Jefferson was an owner of slaves, and I have to say something about Jefferson. The man is a fascinating personality, but he's also a study in contradictions, and I might even go so far as to say a study in hypocrisy. And I could develop that a great deal. That doesn't mean he didn't have some valuable contributions to our country, but Jefferson is the one who writes in the Declaration that all men are created equal. And yet Jefferson owned slaves, and unlike Washington and some others, he didn't free his slaves at his death. including those slaves who might have been his descendants. Strange. But I think the best thing to say about the founding fathers in this area is they sowed the seeds, even though they themselves didn't reap and didn't even live by it, but at least they sowed the seeds for a basis of equality. And putting it into effect is something we're still working on today. I'm going to add one thing else, and then I know we're a little bit over time here, but I'll just add this in regard to the whole issue about racism, that there is such a link between Darwinism and racism. In fact, if you really believe in Darwinism, what basis do you have for disbelieving in any form of racism? What prevents you from saying then that maybe some races have evolved faster and further than others? We think about the Scopes trial in Tennessee in the 1920s, that trial concerning the teaching of evolution. If you go and look at that case, if you look to the Ray County Courthouse there in Dayton, Tennessee, the courthouse where this took place, you go down in the basement, and there they have a museum. In that museum, you will see the textbook that was used to teach evolution, Hunter's Civic Biology. It's in a glass case, and it's opened to the chapter that teaches evolution. Now, it's interesting, they didn't go to the next page. If you'd opened that to the next page, it talks about the evolution of man. And there it talks about the five races of man, the Asian race, the Eskimo race, the American Indian, the African. And then it says, and finally, the most highly developed race of all, the Caucasians, as represented by the people of Europe and North America. And this is the textbook that the American Civil Liberties Union was defending in the Scopes trial. Now, at the same time, across the ocean in Europe, you had a man sitting in jail who was writing a book that was squarely based on Darwinian thought. The book is known as Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. In that book, he develops the notion of the German super race, and he makes the statement in that book that if nature did not wish that superior individuals should mate with inferior individuals, she wishes far less that superior races should mate with inferior races, because then the work of evolution through hundreds of thousands of years of human history would be rendered futile. I think Jerry Bergman is absolutely correct when he says that without Darwin, there would never have been a Holocaust, there would never have been National Socialism, at least not in that form, and there would never have been a Third Reich. I'm not saying Darwinists are racists. I am saying that they have cut out the only firm basis for rejecting racism. And with that, I think it's time for lunch, or do you want to make an announcement first?
Let's give John Eismo a hand.